Next case on our calendar, 07-1703, State of Ohio versus Laura Ann Kalish. Justice Cupp has recused himself in this case. Please have sitting in place of Justice Cupp, Judge John Wilimowski, who's the judge of the Court of Appeals for the 3rd Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Wilimowski. Mr. Schmidt.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Counsel, Jesse Schmidt for appellant. The main issue in this case is proposition of law number one regarding the decision in State v. Foster and its effect on the appellate standard of review in felony sentencing appeals. There is a statute in place that hasn't been overruled by this court. That's revised code 2953.08G2 that sets forth the required analysis for felony sentencing appeals, which is a de novo standard of review applying the clear and convincing evidence standard. In this case, I believe the 11th District Court of Appeals overstepped its bounds and read something into this court's decision in State versus Foster that simply is not there. As this court is well aware, in State versus Foster, several Sixth Amendment issues were addressed regarding judicial fact-finding, and as far as it relates to felony sentencing appeals, this court held that 2953.08G2 remains in effect, but for the severed portions of the statute that require judicial fact-finding. That statute has a lot of power, and it has a lot of due process rights, statutory rights, for criminal defendants in Ohio. Specifically, it allows a defendant to appeal a sentence, requires the trial court to examine the sentencing statutes, RC 29, 2911 and 2912. And although there's no more judicial fact-finding, the Court of Appeals on review has to look at whether those factors and guidelines were considered in sentencing. I think what the 11th District Court has done here is really injured the rights of criminal defendants in Ohio, especially with regards to appeals, because what they're doing is saying that there's no longer a statute that controls felony sentencing appeals, and that's in contravention of what this court has held in State v. Mathis, and also was referenced in State v. Saxon. So that's two cases where this court has said that the statute remains in effect, yet the 11th District Court and four other districts are going ahead and overstepping their bounds and relating back to an abuse of discretion, almost a common law standard, which gives very little opportunity for appellate review of felony sentences. I would ask this court to reiterate and clarify that this statute remains in effect. There is a clear and convincing evidence standard. If a felony defendant appeals and shows by clear and convincing evidence that the statutes weren't followed as far as purposes and principles of sentencing, as well as the sentencing factors for seriousness and recidivism, then that defendant has a right to either be resentenced, remanded, et cetera. And that leads to another portion of the
sentence. How do you do a de novo review of a discretionary call by the judge? What are the factors a trial or a court of appeals would look at when the sentencing now is very discretionary?
Well, again, the sentencing statutes were not overruled but for the fact-finding portions. So the trial court, after Foster, only needs to consider the sentencing statutes, but I think to show that there was consideration, there has to be some addressing of those factors and the facts of the case on the record. Otherwise, there's no opportunity for meaningful appellate review.
Mr. Schmidt, was this question already answered in Mathis? We did talk about the statute 2953.08, but did we specifically talk about the clear and convincing standard surviving, or do we need, if we were to find that this case should be reversed, need it do more than just simply cite Mathis?
I think you would need to, just for the fact that it was dicta in Mathis. It was later referenced in Saxon, and in that case, the court, in pertinent part, held that the sentencing review statute, RC 2953.08G, remains effective, although no longer relevant with respect to the statutory sections severed by Foster.
And we haven't addressed the clear and convincing standard directly then, since Foster?
Correct, okay. Correct. I mean, not, there's been, I guess, a little leeway for the Court of Appeal districts to go the way they have. Second issue here, I'm sorry, one last point on the first issue is that the sentencing 2953.08G also gives the appellate court the ability to modify a sentence. It gives the court the power to do that. What the 11th District Court has also said in this case is basically that that power is now stripped away by Foster. That's something that also was not a part of the Foster holding, and again would strip defendants of statutory due process rights. And I think that's very important, and also goes back to Senate Bill 2, and really what the 11th District is doing here is taking away a lot of the improvements that were brought about by Senate Bill 2 in 1996.
If we agree with your position in connection with the standard of review, what would you have us do in terms of disposition of this case?
I would ask for, I guess since we're only talking about standard of review, it would be a remand to the Court of Appeals.
Well, and what would that accomplish in practicality for your client? What would we instruct the appellate court to do if we agree with your position?
To apply the correct standard of review and re-review this case and the facts, the underlying facts, as they relate to the sentencing statutes.
And how would that be undertaken, in your view?
Well, the appellate court would have to go back and review the record again.
And if they decided favorably to your client, what outcome would you hope would be achieved by doing that?
Well, factually speaking, I do think...
But what I'm trying to have you focus on is the difference between the discretionary review and the de novo review that you're seeking.
Right.
And in the practical application of that to your client, what is the difference that you perceive?
At the worst end of it, I think the 11th District's decision would allow a court of appeals to simply say, well, this is a second degree felony, and you know, we have a possible range of from 2 to 8 years, and you know, anything between that range is not an abuse of discretion. I think that would be the worst possible end of the decision below in this case. So if the correct standard is applied, obviously a case couldn't be decided that way. In this case, particularly on remand, the Court of Appeals would have to look at the particular facts and not just whether the trial court abused its power in sentencing our client, but whether it actually considered the seriousness and recidivism factors, the factors that go into consecutive sentences, concurrent.
But that does not necessarily change the result that the appellate court reached in this case. You just simply want us to require them to apply a different standard, which doesn't necessarily change what they've done.
Practically speaking, it may not. It may not, but we would like the opportunity at least to have the correct standard of review applied, and as we raised in our brief in the Court of Appeals, we feel that the facts in this case did justify a lesser sentence.
So, counsel, you're talking about a reduced sentence. You're arguing that potentially the Court of Appeals could reduce the sentence after it reviewed the case de novo.
That's correct.
Although that runs afoul of what was said in Foster, does it not? In Foster, we said basically, because of the severance due to Blakely and Apprendi, because of the severance, a judge had unlimited discretion to create a sentence within the range and did not have to state on the record its reasons that it had to do before Foster, correct?
Correct, but
so what are we did say also that 29, 11, and 12 remained, and that the court had to look at the principles of sentencing, consider them. Are you suggesting now that the sections that remain, 11 and 12, are things that the Court of Appeals should take into account when it does a de novo review?
Yeah, yes, I do think the Court of Appeals should take those into account.
Then it becomes a fact-finding court, does it not?
Well, I mean, the statutes require an examination of the facts, so to see whether or not the sentencing statutes were applied, you necessarily have to look at the facts as well.
And isn't the problem here that because of Foster, because of the cutback that the court believed it needed to make as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, that the General Assembly, if it wishes to do the things that it had done in Senate Bill 2, needs to really look at these statutes and modify them to provide what you're asking us to do?
Absolutely, absolutely. I just would like to address the second proposition briefly. I think in this case, the 11th District went out of its bounds, boundaries, not only by ignoring precedent of this court, but as well ignoring precedent of its own district with differently constituted panels. Stare decisis requires an examination, a full examination of precedent before a court can overrule that precedent. And the precedent in this case is that the 11th District and the Court of Appeals across Ohio followed 2953.08G2. Stare decisis stands for the proposition that courts should stand by the past decisions and do not disturb settled things. That's Rocky River versus State Employee Relations Board from 1989. In that case, this honorable court held that stare decisis is of fundamental importance to the rule of law, and like the United States Supreme Court, this court recognized that our precedents are not sacrosanct, for we have overruled prior decisions where the necessity and propriety of doing so has been established. But any departure from the doctrine of stare decisis demands special justification. In this case, there was absolutely no justification. There was no examination of that standard or the standard how it was reiterated in the Galatas case, where this court also examined stare decisis. And in Galatas, this court held, in summary, that the court has to look at the past precedent and can only overrule if the decision was wrongly decided at that time or changes in circumstances no longer justify continued adherence to the decision. Number two, if the decision defies practical workability. And three, if abandoning the precedent would not create an undue hardship for those who relied upon it.
Counsel, the state says that they didn't overrule it, that it was merely modified. What effect does that have?
I think they did overrule it because my reading of this case, the Kalish case, is that the 11th District is saying that 2953.08 basically no longer exists. And they did that without any constitutional justification or without any precedent from this court.
Well, if you have two different decisions from one appellate district, shouldn't that be an en banc situation?
I'm sorry?
If you have two different decisions from one appellate district, shouldn't that be a subject of an en banc proceeding?
Most appropriately, yes. I mean, something needs to be corrected. Obviously, you can't have one person with a sentencing appeal on one day has one standard of review, and then the next day there's another standard of review. And even since this case reached this court, the 11th District in State versus Payne is now saying that in limited circumstances, the statute still applies. So there, I think, is the problem with the stare decisis issue. If there are no further questions, I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Ms. Rezai.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Alana Razai, and I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney in the office of Charles E. Colson in Lake County, Ohio. And I'm here today representing the state of Ohio appellee in this matter, and I'm asking the court to affirm the 11th District's decision to apply an abuse of discretion standard to this type of sentencing appeal post-Foster. In this case, the appellant had challenged her sentence under 29-29-11. She alleged that the sentence was not imposed. It was an inconsistent sentence. And in making that argument, she based it on the trial court's improper balancing of revised code sections 29-29-12's seriousness and recidivism factors, and alleged that a shorter sentence should have been imposed because the trial court improperly balanced those factors. And it is my contention that in this type of challenge, the standard of review should be for an abuse of discretion. I say that because in Foster, this court held that trial courts have full discretion to impose a sentence within the authorized statutory range and are no longer required to make findings or give their reasons for imposing more than the minimum, maximum, or consecutive sentences.
We did, however, say that they must consider the principles and purposes of sentencing under 29, 29, 11, and 12. Why shouldn't we look to those sections as the potential for any change on appellate review?
I was getting exactly to that point, Justice. In exercising that discretion, it's not unfettered discretion. This court didn't give trial courts unfettered discretion in Foster. What it did, it required courts to still consider 29-29-11 and 29-29-12. Those statutes address the purposes and principles of sentencing and the seriousness and recidivism factors. Those statutes, both of them, have discretionary underpinnings that are consistent with the holding in Foster and in applying an abuse of discretion standard of review.
Would you concede that the appellate standard of review post-Foster is not solely abuse of discretion?
I would agree with that. It is not the sole standard of review post-Foster. The clear and convincing standard as to whether or not a sentence is imposed contrary to law remains in effect. That's consistent with this court's holding in Mathis and in Saxon and Foster.
In this case, Counselor, contrary to law would be less than 2 or greater than 8. Is that correct?
It would suggest something that is outside of the range, that the court clearly violated the law, whether that's it considered something that it was not supposed to consider, or failed to do something that it was required to do and didn't do that. An example would be sentencing outside the range for the felony, for the degree of the felony underlying the offense.
And it's more than that, though.
It is. It would be something like the trial court fails to notify a defendant of post-release control. That would be something that would be considered contrary to law. It's statutorily impermissible. It's a clear error of law.
Or fails to consider the principles and purposes of sentencing.
Exactly. That could be something that could, if there's nothing indicating in the record that the court considered 29-29-11 and 29-29-12, that could be said to be contrary to law and reviewed for this de novo clear and convincing standard of review. The de novo clear and convincing standard of review set forth in 2953.08G2 is no longer compatible with the holding in Foster. And it no longer makes sense to use that standard of review when reviewing trial court's discretion in imposing a sentence. Essentially what they'd be reviewing is discretionary factors.
But isn't it the sentencing error? It's almost as if there is any sentencing error, it would be considered contrary to law. And if you look at it that way, like failure to follow Section 11 or 12, failure to sentence within the range, any type of error could be considered contrary to law. If that's the case, then your standard has to be clear and convincing under 2953.08G2.
Any legal error would be reviewed as it could be said to be contrary to law.
Give me an example of a sentencing error that would not be contrary to law.
If the defendant's going to challenge that the court improperly balanced the seriousness and recidivism factors and is going to say the court didn't give enough weight to the defendant's remorse, or it should have paid more attention to the fact that the victim didn't suffer psychological harm, something along those lines. Those are factors that the court in its discretion must consider when imposing a sentence. It wouldn't be an error of law if the court,
the challenge
is that it didn't consider it, if it didn't give enough weight. The two aren't compatible.
It sounds as if it's an error that the defendant is arguing, you're arguing for a standard that is not clear and convincing, but if it's for the state, you're using a different standard.
No, that I'm not advocating that. What I'm saying is that in 2929.12a specifically provides that a trial court has the discretion to determine the most effective way to comply with the purposes and principles of sentencing as set forth in 2929.11, and it does that through its consideration of the seriousness and recidivism factors. That statute indicates an intent by the General Assembly that when reviewing the court's consideration of the seriousness and recidivism factors, it should be reviewed for an abuse of that discretion. If the court has discretion to consider the factors, what other way would you review the court's consideration? Which is what Justice Stratton was getting at, was that you can't really have a de novo review of factors that are in and of themselves discretionary.
When you talk about the legislative intent, I'm sorry, but Senate Bill 2 was premised on an idea that there were going to be many changes in the sentencing law. There were going to be points of appeal for the defense as well as the state. And with Foster, we basically did surgery on Senate Bill 2. And so a lot of the points that were favorable to the defense are now gone. The state still has its ability to appeal and so on, but the defendant's rights have been cut way back. So when you're talking about the intent of what is left, it's really misleading because we took out some of the things that were favorable to the other side.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. However, there still remains a good portion of Senate Bill 2 that is in effect, and a defendant's appellate rights have been altered somewhat, but they're still entitled to a meaningful appellate review post-Foster. And as you suggested, it is time for the General Assembly to take action. Mm-hmm. And since the decision has come out in Foster, which was in February of 2006, the statutes, even those sections that you severed from the code and found to be unconstitutional, still remain in those sections. So it could just be that it's going to take time to revamp the statutes. But right now, with the way the state of the law is, based on the holdings of this case, the most consistent analysis should be that a review, if the court considers the seriousness and recidivism factors, and there's an indication on the record that those purposes and principles of sentencing have been they've been achieved through the consideration of the seriousness and recidivism factors, those should be reviewed for an abuse of discretion.
Under that standard, then, of an abuse of discretion, 295308G2 says, in part, that an appellate court may increase, reduce, or otherwise modify a sentence that is appealed, or may vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing. Do you agree that an appellate court still has the authority to modify a sentence or reduce it under that section on an abuse of discretion standard?
Under an abuse of discretion standard, I would have to submit that the appellate court would not have the ability to modify a sentence. An abuse of discretion standard sets forth the fact that an appellate court cannot substitute its judgment for that of the trial court. So with that said, they wouldn't be able to modify it. However,
What does 295308G2 mean?
It means that if 295308G still remains in effect as to for downward departures and for judicial release, as the Mathis opinion makes very clear what still remains specifically in effect. And as to that, the appellate court can still modify, vacate, and remand when their findings on the record regarding 2929.13B or D or 2929.20 for judicial release. That remains intact. With the fact that those findings have been severed, 2953-08G was geared for an appellate court to review the non-discretionary findings that were mandated by the General Assembly, which have now been excised by this court.
There have been other courts that have looked at petty offenses committed by defendants with extremely high punishments imposed by trial courts, and those have been reversed based on an abuse of discretion. So if we had a case theoretically of a relatively minor nonviolent property crime and a maximum penalty, could that, in your view, constitute an abuse of discretion on the part of a trial court?
I'm not sure I'm following you, Your Honor.
All right.
I know for misdemeanors, I believe they're reviewed. The standard is whether or not the court abused its discretion. There is a separate, when we're looking at felonies, the standard of review is different. I don't know if I answered your question.
I'll let it go.
I'm sorry. Just to make this clear, when that statute, when 2953-08G, this de novo clear and convincing standard of review went into effect, it was when those judicially mandated findings were also in effect. Those are no longer to be considered post-Foster.
It was part of the same legislation.
2953-08G2, I believe a portion of it went into effect with Senate Bill 2, and then it was later amended in 2000.
Okay. So, but so you're saying that the genesis was the whole changing of the legislative landscape with respect to criminal sentencing.
Yes, that statute went into effect with Senate Bill 2 to address the concerns that Senate Bill 2 was seeking to address.
So your overall overarching theory is the statute, even though it may not have been knocked out by Foster, has no reason to be any longer.
In regards to when a court, when we're looking at 292911 and 292912, I think it still remains in effect when there is a clear error of law and it can be said that the sentence is contrary to law. But if in the case that we have here, all that was challenged was the fact that the sentence was inconsistent and the court improperly balanced the seriousness and recidivism factors. In that setting, it no longer makes sense to follow the language in 2953-08-G2, this clear and convincing de novo standard. You cannot review discretionary factors clearly and convincingly, or de novo. I don't know what you would be looking for, or what an appellate, it would be in essence substituting its judgment, reweighing the factors that wouldn't be proper, and it goes against purposes and principles of sentencing and the discretion that is granted to trial courts when determining how to achieve those purposes and principles.
So basically, the defendant has no recourse in a situation where a sentence is within a range, is what you're saying.
No, they could still review it. An abuse of discretion doesn't equate to something becoming unreviewable.
Well, in this case, though, we had at least one dissenting judge that looked at it and said, based on a de novo review, I believe that there was an improper use of the balancing factors in 11 and 12.
Yes, the dissenting judge in this case, I think it specifically said that there should have been more consideration given to one of the recidivism factors, indicate that the situation wasn't likely to recur.
Right, and so under G2, she would have modified the sentence. Which
apparently,
I mean,
that is what she would have done.
Okay.
It doesn't. That is not compatible with what this court held in Foster.
Well, but in Foster, we didn't sever the language respecting G2 with respect to clear and convincing and sentences contrary to law, and we left in effect 11 and 12.
Exactly. Specifically, 8 didn't address that clear and convincing standard. I think this is perhaps an unintended consequence of the Foster decision, that by giving trial courts full discretion to impose a sentence within the range, it's no longer compatible with this clear and convincing de novo standard of review.
So possibly we need to modify Foster.
Or clarify. Foster and Mathis. I don't disagree that the sentencing statute remains in effect, that 2953-08 is still effective, although no longer relevant with the portions that were severed by Foster.
I mean, the problem is to let the appellate courts know how they are to review these sentences. That's the real quandary that we're in.
We are. It's clear. A review of all the cases, there's mass confusion across all the appellate districts and within the districts. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be some clarification.
Thank you, Ms. Rezai.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, you saved about half a minute of your time.
As far as any error contrary to law, as stated in the 2953.08, I think that pretty much covers any felony sentencing appeal, because you're always looking at whether there is an error as far as the sentencing statutes, constitutional issues, or other legal issues. And as far as the power to modify, the 11th District has taken that away with the abuse of discretion standard. That is not consistent with RC 2953.08G2. And specifically, they cited a case by this court that said, further, when applying the abuse of discretion standard, an appellate court may not substitute its judgment for that of the trial court. That's Pons versus Ohio State Medical Board, 1993, a civil case where this court looked at the abuse of discretion standard. So I think the court below on this case clearly also took that portion, surviving portion of the statute we've been talking about, and also eliminated it as far as the defendant's appellate rights.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.